It could be, I conceded, my mind drifting back to Oedipus and the first time I had heard about the riddle. Yet there may be other meanings, too, I added. For example, what if the Sphinx somehow provides a clue to the nature of the library, or even to its structure or its location? The dreaming mind could be very complex. I wasn't there long enough to find out, she answered. Are you aware of anything else in the room? Yes, she said immediately. There was a man nearby, dressed in a long, white robe. I guess he was the librarian. He decided who could come into the room and who could not. For some reason, I was allowed in. At this point, my practical mind could not contain itself any longer. What kind of library doesn't have books? I blurted out. That's the strange part, she began to explain. All I had to do was to put my arms out with my palms up and whatever book I needed began to form right in my hands. In no time the book was complete. It seemed to come right out of the wall and solidify in my hands. What kind of book did you receive? I don't remember exactly. A book about me, about my lifetimes. I was afraid to open it. Afraid of what? I don't know. That there was something bad there, something I would be ashamed of. Did the librarian help you? Not really. He just began to laugh. Then he said, is a rose ashamed of its thorns? And he laughed some more. Then what happened? He led me out, but I felt that eventually I would understand what he meant and I would come back and not be afraid to read from my book. She grew silent, pensive. Was that the end of the dream? I prodded. No. After leaving the library, I went to a classroom where I was taking a course. There were 15 or 20 other students there. One young man seemed very familiar, like he was my brother. But he wasn't my brother, Charles. She was referring to her present life brother in California. What kind of a course were you taking? I don't know. Was there more? I asked. She responded hesitantly. Yes. I wondered why she hesitated now, after already relating some very unusual dream scenes. A teacher appeared, she continued, in a voice slightly more than a whisper. He had the most intense brown eyes. His eyes would change to a beautiful purple color, then back to brown again. He was very tall and wore only a white robe. His feet were bare. He came to me and looked deeply into my eyes. Then what? I felt the most incredible love. I knew that everything would be all right, that everything I was going through was part of some plan and that the plan was perfect. Did he tell you that? No. He didn't have to. In fact, he didn't say anything. I just felt these things, but somehow they seemed to be coming from him. I could feel everything. I knew everything. I knew there was nothing to fear. Ever. And then he walked away. What else? I felt very light. The last thing I remember is floating in the clouds. I was feeling so loved and so safe. Then I woke up. How do you feel now? I feel okay, but it's fading. I can remember everything about the dream, but the feeling is getting weaker. The traffic driving over here didn't help. Everyday life, interfering again with transcendent experiences. A woman wrote to me, thanking me for writing my first book. The information in the book helped her to understand and accept two dreams she had had, dreams that were more than 2 decades apart. Her letter was destroyed when Hurricane Andrew ripped through my office, but I remember it well. From the time she was a young girl, she knew that she would have a special child named David. She grew older, got married, and had 2 daughters but no son. She reached her mid-30s, and she became more and more concerned. Where was David? In a vivid dream, an angel came to her and said, "You can have your son, but he can only stay for 19.5 years. Is that acceptable to you?" The woman agreed. A few months later, she became pregnant, and soon David was born. He was indeed a special child, kind, sensitive, and loving. An old soul, she would say. She never told David about her dream and the agreement with the angel. It came to pass that he died at 19.5 years of age due to a rare type of cancer of the brain. She felt guilty, anguished, grief-stricken, despondent. Why had she accepted the angel's offer? Was she somehow responsible for David's death? In a vivid dream a month after David's death, The angel reappeared. This time David was with the angel, and David spoke to her. "Don't grieve so," he said. "I love you. I chose you. You did not choose me." And she understood. Chapter 16. It is again a strong proof of men knowing most things before birth, that when mere children they grasp innumerable facts with such speed as to show that they are not then taking them in for the first time, but remembering and recalling them. Cicero. I was momentarily confused. Pedro had walked through a door, in his mind, to another time and another place. By the movements of his eyes, I could tell that he was observing something. "You will be able to talk," I told him, "and yet you will be able to remain in a deep trance state and continue to observe and to experience. What do you see?"
"I see myself," Pedro answered. "I am lying in a field at night. The air is cool and clear. I see many stars."
"Are you alone?"
"Yes. There's no one else around."
"What do you look like?" I asked, looking for details in order to learn more about the time and place in which he had emerged.
"I'm myself. About 12 years old. My hair is short."
"You are yourself?" I questioned, still not realizing that Pedro had merely gone back into his own childhood and not a past life.
"Yes," he answered simply. "Back in Mexico as a boy." Now I understood, and I shifted gears, looking more for feelings. I wanted to find out why his mind had selected this particular memory from the vast panorama available to it.
"How do you feel?"
"I feel very happy. There's something so peaceful about the night sky. The stars have always seemed so familiar and friendly to me. I like to pick out the constellations and watch them march across the sky as the seasons change."
"Do you study the stars in school?"
"Not really, just a little bit. But I read about them on my own. Mostly I like to watch them."
"Does anyone else in your family enjoy watching the stars?"
"No," he answered. "Only me." I subtly shifted now to appeal to his higher self or intelligence, to his expanded perspective, to learn more about the importance of this memory. I was no longer speaking to the 12-year-old Pedro.
"What is the importance of this memory of the night sky?" I asked.
"Why did your mind select this particular one?" He was silent for a while. His face softened in the thin afternoon light. "The stars are a gift to me," he began softly. "They are a comfort. They are a symphony I have heard before, refreshing my soul, reminding me of what I had forgotten. They are even more," he continued, a bit enigmatically. "They are a path guiding me to my destiny, slowly but surely. I must be patient and not get in the way. The schedule is already set." He was silent again. I let him rest as a thought crept into my mind. "The night sky has been here far longer than mankind. At some level, haven't we all heard that ancient symphony? Are all of our destinies guided as well?" And then another thought, very clear in its words but not at all in its meaning. "I, too, must be patient and not get in the way of Pedro's destiny." This thought came to me like an instruction. It turned out to be a prophecy. As patients like Elizabeth and Pedro challenged many of my old beliefs about life and death and even about psychotherapy, I also had begun to meditate, or at least to muse, every day. In deeply relaxed states, thoughts, images, and ideas often popped suddenly into my awareness. One day a thought came with the urgency of a message. I needed to take a close look at those patients of mine who had been in therapy for a long period of time. My chronic patients. Somehow I would now see them more clearly, and this clarity of vision would also teach me more about myself. Those patients who were coming to me now for regression therapy, visualization techniques, and spiritual counseling were doing extremely well. But what about this other population of patients, many of whom were in therapy with me before my books were published? Why would I see them more clearly now? What was I to learn about myself? As it turned out, quite a lot. I had stopped being a teacher to many of these long-term patients. Instead, I had become a habit and a crutch. Many had become dependent on me, and instead of challenging them to be independent, I had accepted the old role. I had become dependent on them, too. They paid the bills, flattered me, made me feel indispensable to them, and reinforce the stereotype of the physician as demigod in our society. I had to face my ego. One by one I faced my fears. Security was the first. Money is neither good nor bad, and although important at times it confers no real security. I needed more faith. In order to take risks, to commit myself to right action, I had to know that I would be all right. I examined my values, what was important in my life and what was not. As I remembered and realigned my faith and values, my concerns about money and security disappeared, like a fog lifting in the sunlight. I felt very safe. I looked at my indispensability and my need to feel important. This is another illusion of the ego. We are all spiritual beings, I remembered. All of us are equal beneath our exteriors. All of us are important. My need to be special, to be loved, could only truly be met at a spiritual level, from deep within myself, from the divinity within. My family could help, but only up to a point. Certainly not my patients. I could teach them, and they could teach me. We could help each other for a while, but we could never satisfy each other's deepest needs. That quest is a spiritual one. Physicians are highly trained teachers and healers, but hardly demigods. We are just highly trained people. Physicians are spokes on the same wheel as all the other helpers in our society. People often hide behind their professional labels and facades, doctor, lawyer, senator, and so on, most of which were not even built before our 20s or 30s. We have to remember who we were before our titles were conferred. It is not only that we are all capable of becoming loving and spiritual people, people who are charitable, kind, and peaceful, filled with serenity and joy. We already are. We have just forgotten, and our egos seem to prevent us from remembering. Our vision is clouded, our values are upside down. Many psychiatrists have talked to me about feeling trapped by their patients. They have lost the joy of helping. I remind them that they are spiritual beings, too. They are trapped by their insecurities and by their egos. They, too, need the courage to take risks and to leap into health and joy. Chapter 17, For we have come by different ways to this place. I have no feeling that we met before. No deja vu. I don't think it was you in lavender by the sea as I rode by in AD 1206 or beside me in the border wars. Or there in the guillotines, 100 years ago, lying with me in the silver green grass above some mountain town. I can tell by the natural ease with which you wear fine clothes and the way your mouth moves when you speak to waiters in good restaurants. You have come the way of castles and cathedrals, of elegance and empire. Robert James Waller. By the time I had finished counting backward from 10 to 1, Elizabeth was already in a deep hypnotic trance. Her eyes were fluttering under their lids. Her body was limp, and her breathing had slowed into a very relaxed rhythm. Her mind was now ready for time travel. I took her back slowly, this time using a peaceful mountain stream as a gateway to the distant past. She walked across the stream into a beautiful light. Walking through the light, she emerged in another time and another place, in an ancient lifetime. "I'm wearing thin sandals," she observed, after I had instructed her to look at her feet. "There's a binding just above the ankles. I have a long white dress of different lengths. Over it is a veil-like covering down to my ankles. The sleeves are very wide and end at my elbows. I'm wearing golden bracelets at 3 different levels of my arms." She was observing herself vividly and with great detail. "My hair is dark brown and long, below my shoulders. My eyes are brown, too. My skin is light brown." "You are a girl," I assumed. "Yes," she patiently answered. "About how old are you?" "About 14. "What do you do? Where do you live?" I fired at her, asking 2 questions before she had a chance to answer. "On the temple grounds," she responded. "I'm training to be a healer and to help the priests." "Do you know the name of this land?" I asked. "It is Egypt. A long time ago." "Do you know the year?" "No," she replied. "I don't see that. But it is very long ago. Very old." I returned to her memories and experiences of that ancient time. "How did you happen to receive this training, to be a healer and to work with the priests?" "I was selected by the priests, just as the others were. We are all chosen, according to our talents and abilities. The priests know this from the time we are very young. I wanted to know more about this selection process. How do the priests know about your talents? Do they observe you in school or with your parents?
Oh, no, she corrected me. They know intuitively. They are very wise. They know who has the ability in numbers and should be an engineer or a counter or a treasurer. They know who can write and scribe. They know who has military potential and should be trained to lead armies. They know who will make the best administrators. These will be trained to be governors and officials. They know those who possess healing and intuitive abilities, and these are trained to be healers and advisors and even to be priests. So the priests decide what occupations people train for, I summarized.
Yes, she concurred, talents and potentials are divined by the priests when the child is very young. His training is then set. He has no choice. Is this training open to everyone?
Oh, no, she objected. Only to those of the nobility, to those related to the pharaoh.
You must be related to the pharaoh?
Yes, but his family is very large. Even distant cousins are considered part of the family.
But what of very talented people who are not related?
I asked, my curiosity causing me to linger at this family selection system.
They can get some training, she again patiently explained. But they can only progress so far.
To be assistants to the leaders, who are relatives of the royal family.
Are you a relative of the pharaoh?
I asked.
A cousin, not too close.
Close enough, I uttered.
Yes, she answered. I decided to move on, even though I already knew that the patient after Elizabeth had cancelled her appointment that day. So time was not hurrying me along as much as usual.
Do you have any family with you?
Yes, my brother.
We are very close. He is 2 years older. He has also been chosen to train as a healer and priest and we are together here. Our parents live some distance away, so it is very good to have my brother with me. I can see him now.
I risked another distraction, looking for clues to understanding Elizabeth's relationships.
Look closely at his face.
Look into his eyes. Do you recognize him as anybody in your current life?
She seemed to be peering into his face.
No, she said sadly. I don't recognize him. I had somewhat expected her to recognize her beloved mother, or perhaps her brother or father. But there was no identification. Go ahead in time now to the next important event in that Egyptian girl's life. You can remember everything. She went forward in time. I am 18 now. My brother and I are much more advanced now. He is wearing a white and gold skirt that is short. It ends just above his knees. He is very handsome, she noted.
How are you more advanced?
I inquired, bringing her focus back to the training. We have many more skills. We are working with special healing rods that, when mastered, greatly speed up the regeneration of tissues and limbs. She paused for a few moments, studying these rods. They contain a liquid energy that flows through the rods. The energy is concentrated at the point of regeneration. You can use this to grow limbs and heal tissue, even dying or dead tissue. I was surprised. Even modern medicine cannot accomplish these feats, although nature can, as with salamanders and other lizards, which can regrow detached limbs or tails. The latest research in traumatic spinal cord injuries is just now leading to the beginning of controlled nerve regeneration, about 4,000 to 5,000 years after Elizabeth's work with healing rods that could induce limb and tissue regeneration. She could not articulate how the rods worked, other than with energy. Elizabeth did not have the vocabulary or mental concepts to understand and explain. She began to speak again, and the reasons for her lack of understanding became clear. At least that's what they tell me. I am young and a girl. I have held the rods, but I have never seen them work. I have not yet seen the regeneration. My brother has seen this. He is allowed, and when he is older he will be allowed this knowledge of regeneration. My training will be ended before that level. I cannot progress to that level, for I am a female, she explained. He will be allowed the knowledge of regeneration, and you will not? I questioned. That is true. She commented. He will be allowed to know higher secrets, but I will not. She paused, then added, I am not jealous of him. It is the custom, a foolish custom, because I have more ability to heal than many men. Her voice dropped to a whisper. He will tell me the secrets anyway. He has promised me. He will teach me how the rods work, too. He has already explained many things to me. He has told me they are trying to revive people who have recently died. Who have died? I echoed. Yes, but this must be done very quickly, she added. How do they do this? I don't know. They use several of the rods. There are special chants. The body must be positioned in a certain way. There is more, but I do not know. When my brother learns, he will tell me, she ended her explanation. My logical mind arrived at the assumption that the people allegedly being revived were not really dead yet but probably near death, like patients recovering from near-death experiences. After all, they did not have equipment to monitor brainwave function in those days. They could not pinpoint the absence of brain activity, which is our modern definition of death. My intuitive sense told me to keep an open mind. Other explanations could exist, explanations beyond my current comprehension. Elizabeth was still silent, so I resumed the questioning. Are there other forms of healing that you do? I asked her. There are many, she responded. One is with our hands. We touch the area of the body that needs the healing and send energy directly there, through our hands. Some don't even need to touch the body. We feel above the person's body tor areas of heat. We disperse the heat and smooth the energy. The heat must be dispersed at several levels above the body, not just the closest, she explained. She was speaking rapidly now, describing ancient variations of healing techniques. Others can heal mentally. They can see the problem areas in their minds, and they mentally send energy to those spots. I can't do this yet, she added, but I will learn eventually. Some touch the person's pulse with their second and third fingers held together and send energy directly into the flow of blood. You can reach the internal organs this way, and you can see the cleansing energy leaving through the person's toes. Elizabeth continued her rapid and increasingly technical explanation. I am working now with putting people into very deep levels of trance and having them also see the healing as it occurs, so that they complete the healing transformation on the mental level. We give them potions to help them go very deep. She paused for a moment. Except for the potions, this last technique very much resembles the hypnotic visualizations that I and others are using in the late 20th century to stimulate the healing process. Are there more methods? I inquired. The ones that evoke the gods are reserved for the priests, she answered. These are forbidden to me. Forbidden? Yes, because women cannot become priests. We can become healers, and we assist the priests, but we cannot do their functions. Oh, some women call themselves priestesses and play musical instruments in the ceremonies, but they have no power. With some sarcasm in her voice, she added, they are musicians like I am a healer, they are hardly priests. Even Hathor mocks them. Hathor was the Egyptian goddess of love, mirth, and joy. She was also the goddess of festivity and dance. Elizabeth was probably remembering one of Hathor's more esoteric functions, that of defender and protectress of women. Hathor's mockery of these priestesses underlined the empty grandiosity of their titles. Elizabeth grew silent again, and as she did, my mind drew parallels to the current time. Glass ceilings seemed to be as old as time itself. The road to advancement in this period of primitive Egypt seemed to be restricted to only a few. Relatives of the pharaoh, who himself was considered half-divine, could advance. But female relatives would soon bump into the gender barrier. Male relatives of the pharaoh were the privileged few. Elizabeth was still silent, and I urged her forward. Go ahead in time to the next important event in that life. What do you see? My brother and I are advisors now, she commented, after progressing a few more years into the future. We stand behind the governor of this area and we advise him. He is a great administrator and a good military leader, too. But he is impulsive and needs our intuition and inner guidance. We help to balance him. Are you happy doing this? Yes, it is good to be with my brother. And the governor is usually kind. He often listens to our advice. We do our healing work also. She seemed contented, if not ecstatic. She had not married, so her brother was her family. I moved her ahead in time. She was visibly upset now. She began to cry, then stopped. I know too much for this. I must be strong. It is not that I fear exile or death. Not at all. But to leave my brother. That is hard. Another tear fell. What happened? I asked, somewhat startled at the sudden decline in her fortunes. The governor's son became severely ill. He died before anything could be done. He knows about our work with regeneration and our attempts to bring the recently dead back to life. So he demanded that I bring his son back from the dead. If I did not, I would be sent to permanent exile. I know that place. Nobody returns. And the son? I asked hesitantly. He could not be returned. It was not allowed. So I had to be punished. She was again sad and the tears welled up once more in her eyes. It makes no sense, she said slowly. I was never allowed to learn about the rods. I was never allowed to acquire the knowledge of regeneration and revival. My brother taught me a little, but not enough. They didn't know he told me anything. What happened to your brother? He was away, so he was spared. All the priests were away. Only I was around. You returned in time to see me before the exile began. I don't fear exile or death, only leaving him. There is no choice. How long are you in exile? I asked. Not very long, she answered. I know how to leave my body. One day I left my body and did not return. That was my death, for without the soul, the body dies. She had jumped to that point and was speaking from a higher perspective. As simple as that? There is no pain, no interruption in awareness when such a death is chosen. That is why I did not fear death. I knew I could never see my brother again. I could not do my work on that barren island. There was no reason to stay in physical form. The gods understand. She was silent, resting. I knew that her love for her brother would survive physical death, as would her brother's love for her. Love is eternal. Had they met again over the intervening centuries? Would they meet again in the future? I also knew that this memory would help ease her grief. Once more she had found herself in the distant past. Her consciousness, her soul, had survived physical death and centuries of time to emerge once again, this time as Elizabeth. If she could survive through time, so could her mother, so could all of us. She had not found her mother in ancient Egypt, but she had found a beloved brother, a companion soul whom she could not recognize in her current life. At least not yet. I like to think of soul relationships as similar to a large tree with 1,000 leaves on it. Those leaves that are on your twig are intimately close to you. You may even share experiences, soul experiences, among yourselves. There may be 3 or 4 or 5 leaves on your twig. You are also highly and closely related to the leaves on the branch next to yours. They share a common limb. They are close to you, but not as close as the leaves on your own twig. Similarly, as you extend further out along the tree, you are still related to these other leaves or souls, but not as closely as those in your immediate proximity. You are all part of one tree and one trunk. You can share experiences. You know each other. But those on your twig are the closest. There are many other trees in this beautiful forest. Each tree is connected to the others through the root system in the ground. So even though there may be a leaf on a distant tree that seems quite different from you and very far away, you are still connected to that leaf. You are connected to all leaves, but you are the most closely connected to those on your tree, and even more intimately connected to those on your branch, and almost as one with those on your own twig. You probably have met the other souls further out on your tree in previous lifetimes. They may have been in many different relationships with you. Their interactions may have been extremely brief. Even a 30-minute encounter could have helped you learn a lesson or helped them or the both of you, as is usually the case. One of these souls may have been the beggar in the road to whom you gave a heart's gift, allowing you to extend your compassion to another human being and allowing the recipient to learn about receiving love and help. You and the beggar may have never met again in that lifetime, and yet you are part of the drama. Your meetings vary in duration: 5 minutes, 1 hour, a day, a month, a decade, or more. This is how souls relate. Relationships are not measured in time but in lessons learned.